Canada right there, Kristen said, pointing out the window. Never been there, Pilot said. The USA is good enough for me. They took Highway 11 into Baudette, stocked up on food and beer, then turned around on Highway 11 and ran back east a few miles on the two-lane, following behind Chet on land that was as flat as a tabletop, but dark. Dark trees, dark fields, past marshes, shallow lakes, small farms. 15 minutes out of town, Chet swerved off on a dirt track past a rusty mailbox that led through a narrow crack in the roadside tree line. 200 yards back, they came to a dirty white house surrounded by a dirt patch on which two dirty old Chevy pickups were parked. Chet got out of the car, and an old man came to the front door of the house, pushed the screen door open, and stepped out. He had a mustache over a 3-day beard, watery blue eyes behind plastic-rimmed glasses. He was wearing overalls and rubber boots and carrying a pump shotgun, a 12-gauge. He asked Chet, "Where in the hell you been? And what do you want?" "Been in Los Angeles, Pap. Worked on some movies." The old man looked at the others in the caravan and said, "Must not have made any money on them. What do you want, anyway?" "We was hoping to use the campground for a couple of days. Rest up," Chet said. "We've been on the road for a while." "Well, go on ahead." The old man waved at a farther track that led away from the house into the trees. "Makes no never mind to me." "Thanks, Pap. Can we use the water hose when we need to?" "Yeah, I guess." "Be sure you turn it off, and don't bother me no more, and stay off the bridge." Chet walked out to where everybody could see him and yelled, "Follow behind. Road's kinda rough." They all followed him down through the trees to a small lake and a puddle of cracked blacktop at lakeside where they parked and piled out of the cars. A single phone pole stuck out of one side of the parking lot. A single strand of wire threaded through the trees and ended at a box on the phone pole with 4 outlets. At the other side of the parking lot was an outhouse, a two-holer, the first the Californians had ever seen. The overhead line continued to the corner of the lake, jumped over a 15-foot-wide creek, and disappeared into the trees on the other side. A narrow wooden bridge crossed the creek under the wire.
"Not great, but I can live with it," Pilot said. They partied for the next 3 days. Couldn't afford any more cocaine, but they still had the weed and all the beer they could drink. They had more women than the men could keep up with, but the women, even if not all of them were entirely happy about it, would go both ways. They also had to deal with the question of whether Minnesotans were actually aliens. Terry brought it up.
"You know what? Everybody I've seen around here has big heads. You seen that?"
They did. On their runs into town for food and beer, Minnesotans all had big heads. When they spotted a guy with a cowboy hat and a small head, they asked him if he was from Minnesota, and he told them no, he was from Montana.
"Food for thought, that's what it is," Pilot said.
On the morning of the second day, a white van bumped past them, crossed the bridge, and 15 minutes later bumped back out.
"What's over there?" Pilot asked.
"Another campground," Chet said. "Pap doesn't want us disturbing the customers."
"I can't fucking believe he has customers," Pilot said.
Later that day, when he hadn't seen anybody around, Pilot walked across the bridge and found another campground with another phone pole with outlets and 3 single-wide trailers up on blocks. The trailers were locked, and nothing was stirring around them. A garbage can sat near the entrance road, half full of trash, mostly food wrappers. They weren't long for Minnesota.
The first of three Juggalo gatherings was coming up in Wisconsin, and Pilot didn't want to miss it. When they picked up the cocaine in Wisconsin, they could cut it by half and still push it out to the Juggalos for twice as much as they paid for the uncut stuff. After 3 days, they left the campsite, never said goodbye to Pap, heading first for Duluth, then over to Wisconsin. In Duluth, they rambled around town for a while, rodeoed at a McDonald's for cheeseburgers, fries, and malts, then stumbled over a busy mall. Pilot ordered Ellen and Kristen and Linda to set up shop, and though they were doubtful, they found a spot where cross-street foot traffic might give them a chance. Pilot, in the meantime, went inside the mall with Raleigh to look around. They were still there when Belle went by at a jog, spotted them, turned around and came back and said breathlessly, "You know who's here?"
"Who?"
Pilot asked.
"That traveler chick who was with Henry. She's out in the parking lot."
"Shit. She could cause us some trouble," Pilot said. "She's probably looking for him. Or us."
"Yeah. After that crazy fucking Kristen told her that we cut his heart out," said Raleigh. "She's probably got the cops right behind her."
Pilot said to Raleigh, "She doesn't know your car, far as we know."
"So?"
"So we sneak up on her, throw a bag in her head, and toss her in the car."
"Man, she's out in the parking lot," said Belle. "There are 8 million people out there."
"No, there isn't. Not really." Pilot stood up, turned to Raleigh. "Let's get your car." To Belle, he said, "Go tell Kristen to close up shop and get out of here. We'll meet them over in Wisconsin. Tell them wait on the highway."
The thing that Pilot liked about Raleigh was that after a decision was made, no matter how crazy it was, he'd go with you. To get through life, he needed someone to tell him what to do. If that were done, he'd do it. Rob a bank, drown a guy, get the hammer and nails for a crucifix. They got Raleigh's car and started driving loops around the parking lot, and Raleigh rambled for a while.
"Back in Denver, I was working on this golf course running a mower, and I met this golfer guy who said when he was playing and had to take a leak, he'd do it right in the middle of the fairway. He'd put his bag down and stand next to it, hold his dick with one hand, and with the other hand, he'd shade his eyes like he was working out his next shot. He said nobody ever paid any attention to him. But you see a guy standing in the bushes, the women start bitching and moaning about guys exposing themselves. This guy, they had no idea."
"What did you tell me that for?" Pilot asked.
"'Cause if we yank her right off the parking lot like we were helping her in the car, people could look right at you and never have any idea."
"You know what I like about you?" Pilot laughed.
"You're fucking crazy. You're really fucking nuts."
That's what they did. Pilot popped open the side door, grabbed her by the collar of her hoodie, and yanked her into the back seat before she even had a chance to scream, pushed her into the space below the seats, and popped her a few times on the cheekbone with a fist loaded with a roll of quarters. Pop, pop, pop! Raleigh rolled them out of the parking lot, and they were gone. 5. At the mall in Duluth, Lucas and Letty tracked down a security officer who told them that he'd heard of the group attempting to sell sex out at the edge of the parking lot, but hadn't seen them. "A guy named Larry Royce, we've got his address and phone number, came in here and complained. We went right out there, 4 of us, but they were gone. I don't know how long they were here, but I doubt that it was very long." The complainant had given them a description of the RV, but no license plate number.
"It's a Winnebago Mini, beige. Doesn't help much. Maybe Winnebago can tell you how many they made."
Royce said it was pretty beat up. "Looked like it had been pushed hard." Royce had seen 2 women with the RV, no men. He hadn't gone inside. The security man said they'd called the Duluth cops with the story, but he hadn't heard back, and he didn't have anything more. Lucas got Larry Royce's address and phone number and thanked him. Back in the truck, Lucas called the sex crimes unit of the Duluth Police Department. The officer who answered knew of the call from mall security.
We had the patrol division looking for them, but nothing came back. It's possible they crossed over into Wisconsin and headed south or east. Lot of RVs out there, and we didn't have a tag number. We also didn't have any information that sex had actually been sold.
Letty had been on her iPad and reported,
Winnebago made minis for a long time. They might have stopped for a while, but then they started again. Looks like they were making them for at least 20 years.
See if you can find this Royce guy's address, Lucas said. She found it in 10 seconds. They were 6 or 8 blocks away.
We could call him.
Better to talk face to face if we can, Lucas said. Larry Royce lived in a bluebird blue house in a neighborhood of white clabbered houses built on small lawns. He was home, a newer Chevy van parked in front of an older Lund fishing boat, tucked tight in the cracked driveway. A jolly, balding, heavy-set man with blonde hair and a red face, somewhere deep in his 40s, he was happy to talk about the incident, but not in front of Letty.
It's embarrassing, he said.
Lucas suggested that Letty take a walk around the block or wait in the truck. She took her iPad for a walk. Royce sat on his stoop and said,
There were two of them, a thin blonde and a fat redhead. They were wiping the windows of this RV with some Windex and paper towels, and they said, Hi. When I walked past, I said, Hi. And this blonde said something like, Sweaty day for a walk. And I said, Yeah. And she said, I wonder if you could wipe the top of that windshield for me. She couldn't reach the middle of the windshield very well, so I said, Sure. And did that. And she said, Thanks. And then, What have you been up to? I said I was walking over to the mall, and she said, Would you be interested in a party? Well, I'm a salesman. I've been around, and I knew what she was talking about, and I said no. When I got over to the mall, I told a security guy, I mean, we don't have hookers up here. Not in the mall parking lot, anyway. In the afternoon,
he came back with security and the women were gone with the RV.
I think my attitude might have scared them off. They guessed I was gonna call the cops.
He said he was angry with himself for not getting the license plate number, but I wanted to get out of there. The back left corner of the RV had been hit by something, or had backed into something and was crumpled, he said.
Not bad, but there's a pretty good-sized dent.
Lucas took down a full description of the RV and both women. The fat redhead, Royce said, had a white scar under one eye. The blonde?
There was something wrong with her teeth.
You mean like rotten or missing?
No, they were pointed. Kind of freaks me out now that I think about it.
Lucas was waiting when Letty got back, and after he told her what he'd gotten from Royce, she asked, Now what? Going home, he said. There's a good chance they've all left for Wisconsin, and I need to talk to a whole bunch of people about this.
What about Sky?
Lucas waved his hand out at the city. How are we gonna find her? She doesn't have a phone. We don't even know if she's here. It's all too big. Best thing we can do is get back to my office and start calling. Get everybody looking for them. On the way south, Dell called and said that Honey Potts, none of the cops called her Connie Sweat, had agreed to do an interview with Daisy Jones, and Jones, in a pre-interview, had gotten her to say that she'd been sleeping with Marion all through the marriage. He hadn't been faithful to Gloria for even a week.
They're doing the interview this afternoon, and they're rolling it tonight. They want to get it done before there's any chance that Marion's attorney finds out and tries to cut another deal with Honey,
Del said. Good, Lucas said. Still need one more thing.
Shrake and Jenkins are going up to Marion's cabin tomorrow. See if they can find that club, Del said. Sounds like a wild goose chase to me.
Back in St. Paul, Lucas and Letty stopped at the BCA office where Lucas found that nothing had come in on Pilot, but he had gotten two sets of autopsy photos, one set on Henry Mark Fuller and the other on Kitty Place, the actress who'd been killed in Los Angeles. The L.A. cop was right. Lucas took 15 seconds to decide that the same person or persons had killed them both. The photos came up on his computer terminal. He pretended to be looking at something else and didn't tell Letty about them. Henry Fuller no longer looked entirely human. He looked more like a badly butchered pig. The Honey Potts interview had happened and went on at 6 o'clock, after an hour of promos on the early news. About 1 second before the interview went on the air, WCCO reporters went looking for a comment either from Marion or his attorney. Marion refused to comment, but Raines, his attorney, said,
I want to know how she cut a deal like this. Did CCO pay for it? Were the police in any way involved? My client is being framed here, right out in public.
At 11 o'clock that night, Lucas got a call from a Joe Hagstrom, a highway patrolman from Wisconsin, who said he'd spoken to an agent named Bob Stern from Wisconsin's Division of Criminal Investigation.
He said you called down there earlier today looking for a beige Winnebago Mini with a big dent on the back left corner. You find it?
I'm looking at it right now, or what's left of it, the trooper said. It was back in the woods here, you know, northwest Wisconsin. I've got a cabin up there at Lost Land Lake.
You know where Highway 77 crosses the Namekagon River?
Hagstrom asked.
Sure, I drive across there a dozen times a year, Lucas said.
Okay. There's an informal campground off 77, north along the river. You can get there on a dirt trail, but it's mostly for canoeists. We got a call that an RV was on fire back there, and the volunteer fire department went back, and it had almost burned to the ground. The thing is, there was somebody inside.
You mean dead?
Dead now, for sure. The firemen say the smell is unmistakable. They think the fire was deliberate. They could smell a lot of gasoline, and the truck is a diesel.
Have they moved the body? Lucas asked.
Not yet. The metal part of the RV sort of shrank down and encapsulated the living quarters where we think the body is. We're waiting for the crime scene crew to get here.
What time did it blow up?
Around 9 o'clock, a couple of hours ago. The first responders were sheriff's deputies and the fire department, and they didn't know we were looking for a Winnebago Mini with a dent in it. I just got here 10 minutes ago, when I heard some guys talking about it on the radio.
All right, I'm coming. Lucas walked upstairs to the bedroom to tell Weather. She was working in the morning, cutting on somebody. He didn't know the details, but she had gone to bed early.
Don't take Letty, she said.
I won't. I'm going to sneak out, he said.
He stuffed some underwear and socks, a couple of clean shirts, a pair of clean jeans, and his dop kit in an AWOL bag, kissed Weather, collected his gun, a leather jacket, and a ball cap, and went back downstairs. When he rolled out of the driveway in the bends, he could see Letty's silhouette in the lighted window of her bedroom looking out after him. Lucas feared that the body in the RV was Skye's. Some things he thought Letty was still too young for, like the photos of Henry Fuller, like the roasted body of a woman she thought of as a friend. Lucas ran straight north on I-35 to Hinckley, then east across the St. Croix River to Danbury, Wisconsin, and then farther east on Highway 77. There wasn't much traffic, and he ran with lights, but it still took him more than an hour and a half to get to the scene. A cop car was parked on the shoulder of the highway where it crossed the Namekagon, lights flashing in the night. Lucas identified himself, and the cop pointed him back into the woods where Lucas could see light shining through the trees. When he got there, he found Hagstrom, the highway patrolman, a couple of county sheriff's deputies, and two firemen looking at the wreck of the Winnebago. The Winnebago had essentially melted around its core and was blackened with soot, but it was cold now, the fire thoroughly doused 3 hours earlier. Hagstrom shook his hand and said,
"I talked to Stern again. He said this is getting to be a big deal. He told me about California and South Dakota."
Stern was the DCI agent. "It is," Lucas agreed. "Does this thing have a license plate on it?"
"Doesn't have a license plate, doesn't have a VIN tag. I can see where it was, but somebody yanked the tag off before the fire. There should be a couple more numbers stamped on the frame rails, but we can't get at those until crime scene is done."
As they were talking, Lucas had circled around to the left rear corner of the RV, where he saw a bowling ball-sized and shaped dent in the rear quarter panel. He took out his notebook, found the phone number for Larry Royce, the man from Duluth, and called him. When Royce answered, sounding sleepy and annoyed, Lucas identified himself and said, "We might have found that RV you were talking about. You said there was a dent in the back left panel. The one I'm looking at, it's like somebody might have whacked with a bowling ball."
"That's it," Royce said.
Lucas rang off and said to Hagstrom, "We need those VINs. They can get us to the California plates, and that'll get us to the owner, and that'll get us driver's licenses and rap sheets and the whole thing." Hagstrom said,
"Let me call the crime scene crew, see what they say."
Lucas went and leaned against the fender of the Benz while Hagstrom negotiated. When he finished, he said,
"They're not happy, but I told them that the whole thing had burned and been saturated with water and foam, and that the firemen had trampled all over the area around it. They said don't mess with anything inside, but it'd be okay if we jacked up the side rails."
"You got some jacks?" Lucas asked. Between Hagstrom, Lucas, and the fireman, they had four car jacks, and they managed to get the RV's side rail 6 inches off the wet ground along the driver's side door. Hagstrom stretched out with an inspection mirror, which he carried in his car, and with a flashlight, looked at the bottom rail for 10 seconds or so, then stood up and said,
"Waste of time."
"What?"
"Chiseled it off. Looks like a while ago. The chiseled part is rusty and the number is gone. There's another number, but we'd have to get under the engine to look at that one, and that ain't gonna happen with a bunch of little jacks like these," Hagstrom said. "Anyway, they wouldn't know about the first number unless they looked it up, and if they did, they'd know about the second one. Bet that one's gone, too."
Lucas walked around the RV one more time, then down to the dark, shallow river flowing past the impromptu campsite. He called back to Hagstrom.
"One thing you might do. This is a big canoeing river. There might be more campsites downstream."
One of the deputies said,
"There are. Half dozen of them, anyway. Soon as it gets light, you might have somebody down at the different takeout sites see if anybody saw the RV before it burned. Or people or cars who were with it."
The deputy nodded and said, "I'll get that going."
"Good. That could be critical."
Lucas looked over at the RV. It'd be hours before the crime scene crew got inside it. He was 50 miles from his cabin, less than an hour with his flashes, or 20 miles back to a motel in Danbury. "Hell with it," he said to Hagstrom. "I'll be back tomorrow morning. I'm going to run over to my cabin, get some sleep. I can't think of anything else I can do here." He made the cabin by 3 in the morning, stopping once at an all-night gas station in Hayward for gas, Diet Coke, a quart of milk, and a box of Honey Nut Cheerios. The cabin was dark and absolutely silent as he bounced up the driveway until he triggered the motion sensor floodlight on the garage. The only other visible light was on his neighbor's porch. He was unlocking the front door when the neighbor came out in a t-shirt and underpants and yelled,
"Lucas?"
"Yeah, it's me."
"Good, I don't have to shoot you. How long you up for?"
"Just overnight," Lucas yelled back.
"Have a good one."
He went inside and had a bowl of cereal, the moon hanging low out over the lake, putting a long streak of silver on it. It was cool, almost cold. He got a spinning rod from a closet, went out on the dock, and spent 5 minutes casting a rapala into the moonshine, trying for bass or pike, but not trying too hard, smelling the north woods night, looking at all the little dots of light from the cabins around the lake. Then he went inside and tried not to dream about Skye and what might have happened to her. He was back at the burned RV 7 hours later. Hagstrom was gone, replaced by another trooper, more deputies, and a DCI agent named Mike Maddox, who'd come in with the crime scene crew. The crew had cut through the melted side of the RV, and a tech in white coveralls and a face mask was inside, working around the body, which was lying on one side in the center of the RV's cramped living area. Lucas knew right away that it wasn't Skye inside. The victim was male.
"All we know is that the victim is male, average height," Maddox told Lucas. "He's too burned to get anything else, unless we get a DNA hit. No face left, fingers are gone, hair's gone, eyes are gone, toes are gone. We'll get DNA out of the body, of course, but it's unlikely we'll get it from anywhere else, given the fire. Identification is problematic."
"Maybe," said the tech from inside the van.
Lucas and Maddox stepped closer. Maddox,
"Maybe? I thought you said there was no chance."
"That's before I turned him," the tech said. "I think I can see the edge of something that might be a wallet. He was lying on it, protected it from the fire."
"That would be pretty interesting," Maddox said. "Fish it out of there."
"I've got some work to do before I get there," the tech said. "But I'll get to it."
While one tech worked inside, another was working to get at the second VIN number, and when he got to it, found that it, too, had been chiseled away. Then they got a break. The inside tech took 15 minutes to get at it, finally extracting a thin black leather wallet. Another tech took it to a working table and, after photographing it, opened it. Inside, they found a slightly melted but still readable Wisconsin driver's license for Neil Ray Malin, showing an address in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, an expired membership card for an Eau Claire gymnasium, an insurance card for a 2-year-old Ford pickup, and nothing else.
"No credit cards, no money.
Whoever killed him took the money and credit cards, which means that they might be using them," Lucas said. "If one of them was a debit card and they tortured him for the code..."
"We could get a picture," Maddox said.
"Let me get on that."
Maddox tracked it all down in 5 minutes. Malin was no longer living at the address on the driver's license, but his ex-wife was. She wasn't home, and Maddox spoke to the babysitter. She didn't know Malin personally, but said the ex-wife was working at a beauty parlor in Eau Claire.
"I'm gonna stick here, but I'll get an Eau Claire cop to track down his ex and give her the news and get the credit card numbers," Maddox told Lucas.
Wonder what a Chippewa Falls guy was doing with these L.A. freaks.
"A question we're gonna ask," Maddox said. "Maybe he was like that guy in South Dakota. Picked up and killed for the hell of it."
"Don't think so," said the crime scene guy inside the RV. "There's blood everywhere, all over the place. Why would they do that?"
and wind up having to burn their RV.
Lucas stuck his head inside the RV. Have you checked all his pockets? Did he have a cell phone on him?
I've checked all the pockets, no phone.
Lucas turned back to Maddox. Have the Eau Claire cops ask his ex if he had a cell phone. People steal phones. If he had one and they're using it, we might get a GPS location on it.
A few minutes later, Lucas, watching the slow progress inside the RV, said to Maddox,
If you don't mind, I'm gonna run down to Chippewa just to observe. You know, if they locate his apartment.
Fine by me, Maddox said. I'll call ahead and tell them that you're coming.
Chippewa Falls was an hour and 15 minutes away, rolling fast across country on back roads, then down Highway 53. When he arrived, he found that the Chippewa cops had waited for Bob Stern, the Wisconsin investigator, to arrive from Madison. Stern had gotten to Chippewa Falls a few minutes before Lucas, had stopped at the courthouse to pick up a search warrant, and then the cops and Stern had driven in a convoy over to Malin's apartment. Lucas followed his nav system up the hill on the west side of town and caught the Wisconsin cops as they were gathering on the lawn of an old clapboard mansion. Stern saw Lucas getting out of his truck and walked over to shake hands.
How's the old lady?
Cutting somebody open about now, Lucas told him. You divorced yet?
Let's not go there, Stern said. I think she's gonna get the season tickets for the Packers.
Man, that's inhuman, Lucas said. He looked up at the house, which had an expansive front porch, including a comfortable-looking swing, and a bunch of white, life-sized wooden chicken flower boxes, showing off bunches of geraniums, marigolds, and petunias.
Nobody's gone in yet?
Doing that now,
a deputy said. They watched as a sheriff's deputy with the search warrant climbed the porch and knocked on the door. A minute later, an elderly woman in an apron answered, nodded a few times, and then pushed the screen door open.
Let's go, Stern said.
As they crossed the porch, he said,
Ugly chickens, ugly.
The old lady was the owner of the house. Her name was Ann Webster and hadn't seen Malin in 2 days. Malin, she said, rented the top floor of the house and had a separate exit out back. One of the deputies was sent around back to cover it, and the rest of the cops climbed a wide oak floor stairway to a second entry, apparently added when the top floor had been converted into an apartment.
I was never using it. The stairs are too high. So I thought maybe somebody would rent it, Webster told them. I had the nicest family here for 3 years, and then Mr. Malin. He's very quiet. No wild parties or anything like that.
She opened the apartment door with a shiny new key, and they all pushed inside. The apartment was huge as apartments go, and oddly shaped, as it once had contained an oversized master bedroom, with 4 more bedrooms down a long hallway, plus 2 bathrooms. The former master bedroom had been converted into a living room with a cook's kitchen at the far end behind a newly built partition. One of the 4 bedrooms had been converted into a den with a comfortable couch and a compact bar, a stereo system, and a 50-inch television. Another had been converted into an office. The other 2 were still used as bedrooms, although Webster said she was unaware of any overnight visitors.
Hell of an apartment, Stern said.
Webster said Malin paid $2,800 a month for it, and one of the cops said,
That might be the most expensive apartment in Chippewa.
Webster watched as the cops probed the place. She was rolling her hands together as if washing her hands of her tenant. He was a salesman, she said, for horse barns and pole barns at a place called Collins Metal Buildings in Chippewa. Lucas and Stern walked through with the cops, looking behind books and under desks, and then the cops got serious about the search and began pulling the place apart.
They found 4 guns hidden in various drawers, all compact 38-caliber revolvers, fully loaded, and in one drawer, under the revolver, found a couple hundred packs of orange and double-wide zigzags. The main room had wall-to-wall carpeting, but one of the cops found that it had been tacked down. They rolled it one way, found nothing, rolled it the other way, and found several loose floor planks. Under the planks, they found 20 tightly sealed, highly compressed bags of marijuana, probably a pound each, and 2 kilos of cocaine. So it wasn't entirely metal buildings, Stern said. This is good, Lucas said. This gives us a contact point for Pilot, a reason for the two of them to be seeing each other. Wonder if they took his truck, Stern asked. We got people looking for it, haven't heard anything back. He checked with his office, shook his head, and said to Lucas, Nothing. If you see a 2-year-old blue Ford Explorer pickup... The search continued. A half hour into it, Stern took a call, wandered into a corner, looked over at Lucas, hung up. Malin had a debit card with Wells Fargo. It was used twice, once just before midnight last night, then again a little while after midnight. You know, 2 separate days, maximum withdrawals both times, $600 each. There are recognizable photos of the woman who put the card in. Excellent, Lucas said. Better than that, big guy, Stern said. You know where they use them at? Where? St. Paul, Stern said. Lucas stepped back. Ah, man. I probably passed them on I-35 last night. They were heading south, and I was going north. Ships in the night, Stern said. Anyway, Wells Fargo moved the photos to the St. Paul cops, and they sent them down to us. Let me get my iPad. We'll take a look. He was back in 2 minutes with the slate. Got her, he said. He passed it to Lucas. Skye was looking straight into the ATM camera, hoodie back on her shoulders. She looked scared to death. Skye. That's, Stern began. Oh, boy, oh, boy. I'm going, Lucas said. 6. The night before. Neil Ray Malin felt crowded in the RV like a big dog in a small kennel. When he shifted his weight, he could feel the RV move. He was on his feet, his hair like a haystack, fat cheeks with a bristling beard, facing Pilot, both of them angry, and he said, I told you what the terms was. The terms was cash on the barrelhead. I don't want to hear this bullshit about promising to pay. That's not how we do business. That might not be how you do business in the backwoods, but it's how we do it in L.A., Pilot said. I got contacts all over the movie business. We get top price. Excuse me, Malin said, looking around the RV. He was a bulky man with skinny legs. Cowboy boots poked out from under his bootcut jeans. I gotta say, this don't exactly look like a big-time director's place. Hey, we're good for the money. I got a reputation in L.A. Look out the window, you fucking moron. You see any skyscrapers out there? Malin asked. Does that look like Rodeo Drive? He said Rodeo Drive, and Kristen smirked over her pointed teeth and said from behind him, That'd be... Rodeo Drive, dumbass. Rodeo. Fuck a bunch of roads. I'm going, Malin said. If you actually get the cash, I'll be in Chippewa. You got my number. Pilot put his hand up toward Malin's chest. Wait a minute. I ain't waiting, Malin said. He was wearing one of those loose Tommy Bahama Hawaiian shirts and now dropped his hand down to his side, slipped it under the shirt, dropped it again, now showing a compact revolver. I'm going. So now you're showing a gun and we're supposed to be business partners, Pilot said. That's really fucked up, man. Yeah, well, Malin stepped toward Pilot, who didn't step back.
Get the fuck out of the way, Malin said.
Kristen was standing behind him, and she was such a thin woman that Malin ignored her, despite the filed teeth and all the apocalyptic-themed ink. As Malin pushed toward Pilot, she picked up a 10-inch Henkel's chef knife that had been lying under a towel on a sideboard and stuck it in his back. Nothing tentative about it, she stuck it in him as hard as she could, with 110 pounds of weight behind it. The knife went through the peachy silk shirt, deflected off Malin's spine, missed his heart to the right, took out a piece of lung, and emerged on the other side of his body, inside his right nipple. Malin grunted,
"Oh!"
and, with an astonished look on his face, turned to her, the gun momentarily forgotten in his hand. Kristen wrenched the knife free and stabbed him in the neck, the razor-sharp blade sliding off to the left, slicing neatly through Malin's carotid artery. He tried to scream, but failed. Turned to run from the flailing knife, blood pumping from his neck like water from a hose. He crashed into Pilot, almost fell, then threw an arm at Kristen. She fumbled the knife, flipping it up in the air, and it came down on her arm, between her elbow and hand, slicing it open. She tried to snatch at the blade and cut her hand, badly, through the palm, and Malin hit her in the face, and she went down and he rumbled toward the back door, blood still pumping from his neck, his vision going gray like an Apple computer with a bad video card, and then black. He missed the side door to the outside and crashed through a door at the end of the short hallway into a bedroom where a young woman lay on the bed wrapped in silver duct tape. He never saw her, simply crashed on the bed, pushed himself up, and as Kristen followed him with the knife, blundered into sky. Kristen stabbed him in the eye, and he managed to backhand her, then plowed all the way through the RV, almost to the front door, where Pilot whacked him with his scepter, and Malin finally went down, the flow of blood from his neck slowing to a gurgle. Then everything stopped for a few seconds, and finally Pilot said, "Jesus H. Christ." 6 quarts of Malin's blood had painted the inside of the RV. The carpet, the couch, a bolster, an ottoman, the woodwork, towels, the mattress on the bed. The blood had painted all three people in the RV, Pilot, Kristen, and Skye, whom they'd picked up in Duluth. Kristen spit on Malin's body and said,
"Suck on that, asshole."
Pilot said, "Make sure that bitch is still taped up back there." He felt Malin's hip pocket, took out his wallet, extracted $300 in 20s and his credit cards, looked at a half dozen other cards and slips of paper, and found one with 4 numbers, held the paper up to Kristen and said, "Does that look like an ATM code or what?"
"I'm bleeding bad," she said.
She held her hand out, showing the bloody cut, and wrapped a towel around her forearm.
"I need a hospital."
"Not around here," Pilot said. "Not with Malin all carved up like that."
"I need a doc—"
"We'll get you one," Pilot said. Pilot dropped the wallet on the floor and said, "We need to get his keys. Can you use the phone?"
"Yeah."
"Call the guys. Tell them we're heading down to St. Paul. We'll get you a doc. Tell them it was Saturday night fights at the local parking lot and some black dude cut on you. You don't know who it was." As she called, Pilot rolled Malin's body, dug in his pants pocket, and came up with the truck keys. Didn't notice Malin's wallet disappearing under his butt. When Raleigh came up on Kristen's phone, Pilot took it and said, "We got a situation. You need to go to a gas station, tell them your buddy ran out of gas. Get a 5-gallon can if they got one, or a couple of 2-gallon cans. Get over here to the campground. Gotta be fast. We're heading down to Minneapolis." He rang off, and Kristen, who was wrapping a pillowcase around her arm and hand, asked, "What are we doing?" Pilot looked around the RV. "No way we can keep this. No way we can clean it up enough."
There'll always be blood in it, and if we ever get seriously pushed by the cops, they'll find it. And in a couple days, it's gonna stink real bad. We're gonna drive it out in the woods and burn it. In the meantime, you lay towels on the floor so we can walk on something clean, and get in the shower and hose yourself off. I'm going out. I'll be back in a minute.
My arm is really hurting.
Yeah, we'll take care of it.
Pilot went out in the cool night air, walked over to Malin's pickup. Took a while, but in the end, found a kilo of cocaine, the coke he was supposedly buying that night, and 2 pounds of weed. He went back in the RV and said, "Looky what I got." Kristen was just out of the shower. She still had the pillowcase wrapped around her arm. Blood was showing through. She said,
"Oh, my God, I might be hurting, but I'm not gonna be hurting long."
Pilot laid out a few lines, and they snorted them up. Then Pilot, high as a kite, went to shower and change clothes. When he was out, they piled all the blood-stained clothing on top of the body, then walked around to the cab and rolled off into the dark. Raleigh called 10 minutes later and asked,
"Where you at?"
"Coming down to 77. We're gonna go west on 77 until we find a good spot. You got the gas?"
4 gallons.
"I'll be up behind you in 3 minutes. The rest of them are coming along behind me. What are we burning?"
They burned the RV in the campground by the river. Sky was still taped up in the back. The tape wrapped round and round her body, pinning her arms to her sides, but left her hands free. They cut the ankle wraps so she could waddle out, but left the wraps around her knees and thighs so she couldn't run. As she was edging past Malin's body, she saw his iPhone lying on the blood-soaked couch, almost slipping through the couch cushions. She faked a fall.
"What the fuck are you doing? Get up, bitch."
"I fell. Don't hurt me."
Sky managed to get the phone between her hand and her thigh and hold it there. She struggled to her feet and waddled outside. They put her in the back of Boney's station wagon and threw a wool blanket over her. Boney said,
"You move that blanket. I'll get the tire iron out and beat the shit out of you."
Sky never saw the RV burn, but she heard the whoomp when the fire started. The 4 remaining cars in Pilot's convoy fled west on 77, crossed the river into Minnesota, hit I-35, and turned south toward the Twin Cities. Sky could move her hands, from her wrists to her fingertips, but not her arms, nor could she see what her fingers were touching. The back of the old station wagon smelled like dog shit and hay and oil, and the car's shocks were so bad that lying under the blanket was like rolling down a hill in a garbage can. She was afraid the phone would ring and give her away. The rattling car gave her the cover she needed to turn the phone in her hand, find the power button with her index finger, and hold it down until she thought it was turned off. She then twisted around enough to see that the phone screen had gone dark. Then she folded her legs at the knees and managed to shove the phone into her sock. In St. Paul, the convoy rolled into Regent's Hospital. Kristen went in alone and told the duty nurse a story about a fight on the Capitol lawn between a bunch of drunk street people. The cops came and took a statement, and 3 hours later she was sitting on a wall outside the hospital when Pilot came back.
"Didn't cost me anything, but I had to promise to pay," she said.
She'd used Sky's ID, and nobody had looked too closely at the photo. While Kristen was being sewn up, Boney took Sky around to 2 Wells Fargo ATMs, gave her the card and the number, and they pulled out $600 before midnight, and another $600 after midnight, the single-day limit on the card. Then they taped her up again, threw her back into the station wagon, and covered her with the blanket. Sky heard Kristen talking outside the car before they were moving, and so knew the other woman had gotten out of the hospital. She felt the car take a couple of turns, then it accelerated. They were back on the freeway. Which one, she didn't know, but she didn't care. She had one chance, the cell phone. She resolved to wait to use it until she was sure it would pay off. She knew one cell number for sure, Letty's. She mumbled it over and over as she lay under the blanket, hoping for a break. She didn't get it that night. They drove for no more than 15 minutes, then pulled off and parked. Boney rolled down his window, and Pilot said, "We'll stay here for the night. We can get water and food, and they don't give a shit how long we stay. And no cops. Give Skye some water. Don't have to waste any food on her."
"I'm gonna go ahead and fuck her."
"Not here, you asshole. Somebody would see the car bouncing up and down, and then we could have trouble. You can fuck her tomorrow."
"You said we were all gonna party. We were all gonna fuck her tonight."
"Well, you might have noticed we had a little problem," Pilot said. "We don't need to attract no cops." Skye had no idea what time it must have been, but it was late. People were getting in and out of the car, talking, paid no attention to her. At some point, Boney remembered that he was supposed to get her water and so came back and ripped some tape off her mouth and let her drink a bottle of spring water. He said,
"We're gonna get you airtight tomorrow, bitch. Think about that."
She slept for a while, or passed out, or something. She got her break the next morning. They were in Hudson, Wisconsin, where the convoy stopped for gas at a Quick Trip convenience store and breakfast at the McDonald's next door. Before Boney got out of the car, he said,
"You move and I'll kill you. I'll cut your fucking throat."
He got out of the car, and Skye managed to pull the phone out of her sock and turn it on. When the screen lit up, she laid the phone on the floor and, using her thumb, managed to punch in Letty's number. Letty answered on the second ring.
"Hello?"
"Letty, Pilot's got me. They're going to kill me. I think they killed Henry. They killed a man up by Hayward. They murdered him in the RV and set it on fire. They've got me in the back of Boney's car. They're getting gas. I stole this phone."
"Skye! Hide the phone, but leave it on. I think they can track cell phones. You have to turn off the ringer. Do you know how to turn off the ringer?"
"No."
"Do you know what kind of phone it is?" "I think it's an iPhone." "There should be a button on the side of it."
Letty talked her through it, and Skye found the button and pushed it until the ringer tone indicator was down as far as it would go.
"Okay, I think it's off," Skye said.
"Look in the upper left corner of the screen. Does it say AT&T or Verizon or..."
"It says Verizon."
"What kind of car are you in?"
"A station wagon, an old one. It's black and it's funny looking and it stinks. But I don't know where I am. I think we drove out of the city we were in."
"Okay. When they come back, hide the phone in the car in case they search you. Leave it turned on. Now, tell me what happened."
"They picked me up at a mall in Duluth," Skye said. "I was walking in and this car pulls over to the side and this guy gets out and picks me up. Just picks me up and throws me in the back of the car. And Pilot was there and they beat me up and then they taped me up."
"They took her to Hayward," she said, "where they told her that they were going to take her out in the woods for a party. She didn't believe she'd survive it."
"Then something happened, and they killed the man in the RV where they had me. There was a fight, and Kristen got hurt, got cut. We drove for a couple of hours, for a long time, anyway, and then they stopped at a hospital. I think we were in Minneapolis or St. Paul. We were at some ATMs, and I could tell it was a big city."
"Okay. Hide the phone. I'm gonna call my dad." Lucas was on I-94 heading back to the Twin Cities when Letty called.
"Skye called me. Pilot's got her. She thinks they're going to kill her."
She gave him the details of Skye's call, and Lucas said, "She's right. They're going to kill her. I gotta call in. Goodbye." He got the BCA duty officer on the phone and told him the problem. "Get to Verizon, find out where they're at." He gave the duty officer the number that Sky had called from, then called Stern, the Wisconsin DCI agent, and told him what had happened. "It's possible they came back this way. We'll know in a few minutes. Keep me up." Lucas turned on his flashers and went past the town of Menominee at 110. The duty officer called back and said,
"The phone's on Highway 63 in Wisconsin, headed north. They're south of Clear Lake."
"I went through Menominee a few minutes ago. I'm going to take County Q. I think it goes north."
"No, no, I'm looking at a map. Keep going past Q, just a couple more miles up to 128. You'll be faster and closer."
"Okay. You get on to the county sheriffs up there. I don't know what counties they are. Tell them to look for an old black station wagon, maybe California plates. You should be able to vector them in pretty close. Tell them it might be part of a convoy. Everybody in it is wanted for multiple murder. You gotta get me there as quick as you can. I'm gonna call my guy at the DCI.
Lucas got Stern on the phone again. Stern said,
"I'll get my duty guy on our net up there. We need to talk to your guy about what Verizon is telling them. You say this girl is a witness to the Malin killing?"
"Apparently. And I gotta go. My turn's coming up."
Lucas took the off-ramp, took a fast right past the convenience store, drove past a half-dozen cars on the wrong side of the road, punched up the duty officer again, and said,
"I'm on 128.
Take it right straight north to 64. They're in Clear Lake right now."
"Okay. We got nothing going yet in Clear Lake, but we got a highway patrolman coming south on 63. He's in Turtle Lake."
"Hang on, hang on."
"Okay, I'm talking to a guy in Madison. He's saying that the patrolman is talking to the sheriff's department up there. There's a lake right on the highway. Magner. Everything squeezes down."
"I know it.
They're gonna take him there," the duty officer said.
Lucas went past Glenwood City about as fast, he suspected, as anyone had ever done that, watching his nav system for a jog in the road, got through it just fine, then almost drove right through a T-intersection, got straight, and went on.
"Lucas, the phone's north of Clear Lake. They're heading for a collision up at Magner. We got two deputies coming up behind him, too."
"Okay. You told them about the girl? The hostage?"
"Yeah, they're all clear on that," the duty officer said. "They're only 3 or 4 miles out."
Lucas came up on Highway 64, took a right, and ran hard the 3 or 4 miles to the intersection of 63. Now he was behind them, but still well back out of the action.
"What's happening?"
"I don't know, I don't know. Verizon, heck, Verizon said the phone's turned left on a back road. Turned left. They were only 2 miles out of Magner. The deputies coming up behind saw him make the turn. They say he's moving fast now. They're strung up behind him. They're all running behind him, chasing him."
"Shit. One of the other cars in the convoy saw the cops and they called him."
The duty officer went away for a minute, then came back and said,
"They didn't see anything that looked like a convoy. They're all over this guy. They're right behind him."
"I'm coming, I'm coming."
"Where are you?"
"Coming up on Clear Lake, a couple miles out," Lucas said.
"Okay, if you see a Highway JJ just on the north side of Clear Lake..."
"I see it on the nav."
"That'll take you..."
"Okay, the guy's off the road. He ran through an intersection. He's off the road in the ditch."
"What about the girl?"
Long silence, and Lucas repeated it.
"They got the girl?"
"No, I'm hearing that the guy's still in the car. He's got a gun, and he's gonna kill this girl if they don't get him another car."
Lucas took the corner at JJ and headed north.
"I'm north on JJ. Get me in there."
He saw them from a mile away, what looked like 10 cop cars with their flashers going. He came up fast, saw cops behind cars, saw an ancient Chevy Cavalier station wagon in a bean field at the intersection of a narrow side road. It looked as though the driver of the station wagon had tried to make the turn, but missed it, ran through a fence out into the bean field where he bogged down. Lucas pulled up behind the last sheriff's patrol car, climbed out and jogged down to the lead car where the Wisconsin patrolman and a couple of deputies were crouched. The patrolman said,
"You're Davenport?"
"Yeah."
"Stern is on the way. He'll be a while, though."
You talking to the guy?
Off and on. He'll roll down that side window and scream at us, then roll it back up. He seems, nuts. I mean, like, you know, he needs a doctor and medication. Or maybe he's just high. He was yelling some stuff at us like the fall is coming and we're all scared shitless and it won't do us any good because we're all going down. Sounds crazy to me.
Did he say what he wants?
He said he wants a patrol car or he's going to kill her. We told him a guy was coming to talk to him and we could work something out.
He shoot at anybody?
Not yet, but he's got a gun. Randy's got some glasses. He's looking at him.
He pointed over at another car where a deputy was sitting behind a rear wheel, looking at the car in the field with a pair of heavy binoculars.
Looks like a big old revolver.
I'll go look. But what do you think?
Well, honest to God, you know, Phil over there is on the regional SWAT team. He's got his rifle. He could take him out.
Lucas looked back to where a guy had a rifle propped on a sandbag over a patrol car's bumper.
But we're shooting through that window glass. My inclination is, if it looks like he's going to do something, I try to take him out. I mean, if he freaks out and shoots the girl, then it'll be too late, and he seems to be freaking out.
Let me go look, Lucas said.
Sheriff's coming down. He'll be here in 5-10 minutes.
Lucas duck-walked over to the car where the deputy was keeping watch with the binoculars.
Can I look?
He's waving the gun around. Looks like he's arguing with whoever's in the back.
Lucas took the glasses, focused. The car was only 100 feet away, and with the big image-stabilized cannons, he could see individual hairs in the man's beard. He looked like he was in his late 20s, had what appeared to be a propeller-shaped tattoo or maybe an elongated infinity sign on his forehead. He was shouting into the back, kept poking the gun toward the back, then swiveling to look out at the cops.
"Doesn't look good," he said.
"No, it doesn't."
Lucas handed the binoculars back to the cop, sat with his back to the car, and called Letty.
"If I message Sky, will the phone make a sound?"
"I don't know. I think so. But you could call her. The phone won't ring, and she could see the screen light up."
"Give me that number," Lucas said.
Lucas took the number, then crawled over to the car's bumper, whistled at the highway patrolman, and waved him over. When he got there, Lucas said,
"You're running this scene. I've got no jurisdiction. I think I can call her without tipping the guy off. What do you think?"
"I don't know. What do you think?"
"The guy's not just acting crazy. We've got good reason to think he is crazy. I think if we put the rifle on him, and if I call and he reacts, then if it looks like he's going to use the gun, we take him."
The cop bit his lip, thinking, then said, "We've got to do something. I'm not sure we can wait until the sheriff gets here."
"The question is, can our shooter hit him through the window glass?"
"I asked him that, and he said he's shooting solid core. He says he's pretty square to the window glass, and if he shoots at the guy's head, the bullet might deflect a bit, but he'll still hit his head somewhere. A smaller target would be more of a question."
Lucas nodded. "Okay. I'm gonna call her. You tell the rifle guy to be ready, but don't shoot unless it looks like he's about to pull the trigger on her." To the cop with the glasses, he said, "Watch him. Tell me what he does."
He called. When the phone stopped ringing, there was silence. He said quietly,
"This is Lucas, Letty's dad. If you push the round button at the bottom of the phone, the main screen will come up. Then push the green button on the screen, too. It'll switch you to phone mode. Could you do that?"
The cop with the binoculars said,
"He's just sitting there. Looks like he's talking to himself."
Lucas said into the phone, "On the bottom line, there's a square with a lot of dots in it, the keypad. Push that button. When the keypad comes up, push the bottom of the phone against your body. That's where the keypad sound comes from. You need to muffle that. If you've done that, tap any button. Don't hold it down, just tap it quick."
A second later, he got a beep.
"Good. We're talking. Are you hurt?"
If you're hurt bad and need an ambulance right now, tap a button. Silence. Good. You're not hurt. If you think this guy is going to shoot you, that he's seriously going to do it, tap a button. Beep. The patrolman said, "Damn it." Lucas said into the phone, "If you think there's any chance that you can talk him down, give me a beep." Silence. Then a man's voice.
"This is it, this is it. No way out. No way out now. They ain't coming back for me. They ain't coming back. Piece of shit car, piece of shit. You ain't going no place. Don't even think about it, bitch. I'll blow your fucking brains all over the car, that's for sure."
The guy with the binoculars said, "That's him. I can read his lips when I hear the words. She's holding the phone so we can hear him." A cop called,
"The sheriff's here."
A minute later, the sheriff scuttled